Today's program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com, the official page for travel to the Napa Valley, America's legendary wine, food, arts, and wellness capital. For more information, visit www.visitnapavalley.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. In the Drink airs live at 10 a.m. on Wednesday mornings, and we're coming to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn at Roberto's Restaurant. You can also listen to In the Drink on iTunes or on heritageradionetwork.org, where we have all of our past episodes that you can stream. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and when I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at one of our restaurants where I act as beverage director. Our restaurants are Dell'Anima, Lartuzzi, La Picho, and Amphora. Today, I'm really excited to have someone in the industry who I just really like personally quite a bit. I consider her a friend and someone I also look up to. We have Michelle Bichelia from Blue Hill on the show. Welcome to In the Drink, Michelle.
Thanks so much.
It's great to have you. This past week, and you can probably hear my voice is a little bit raspy, and I can blame La Palais on that. That's something that you also took part of. It is a Burgundy celebration that seems to last all week long. What do you think were some of the, you also participated in, what were some of the standout wines of the event for you? Were there some wines that really stood out?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's full of the most amazing wines in the world for a full week. I mean, I think at the tastings, there's the verticals tasting, the grand tasting, the gala dinner, all full of great wines. For me, my favorite is always the verticals tasting. And I think standout producers are always like, you know, Rousseau every year and those kind of things. But this year, there was other people that were there, like Shagnolo. I don't know if you tasted those wines from Saint Véran and Mâcon and Southern.
I was actually paired with Shagnolo for the grand tasting, and so I had never heard of them before.
Awesome,
pretty
wines.
Amazing. Yeah,
yeah. Those were great. The PO wines, who are right next to you at the grand tasting, I think were awesome.
I totally lucked out because I was with PO for the verticals tasting. And I posted a picture on Instagram. I think that guy looks like the French Bon Jovi.
I remember you saying that.
My girlfriend Alyssa does not agree with me, but
I kind of agree with you.
But what a great guy, and what those wines were killer. And those, for me, if someone would have asked me what are the two wines that stood out, I would have said the same thing. The same two producers.
Yeah.
We also both participated in the off-grid tasting.
Yeah, which was great.
Which is amazing, huh?
Yeah.
Which was meant to highlight some of the hidden gems of Burgundy. Do you have any Burgundian hidden gems on your list at Blue Hill?
Yeah, totally. I mean, well, we have the Shagnolo wines. We have a couple of the Chablis that I poured. So I did the Chablis table. I curated the list like you did for, what did you do?
The Côte Chalonnaise.
Côte Chalonnaise, yeah, exactly. I had definitely picked some of the wines right away that I'd already had on the list. One being the Moreau Naudet Chablis. They make a Chablis AOC, but they also make this other Chablis that's an old vine cuvée. I think it's called Parguet. And we poured that at the tasting, and it is a standout, delicious, amazing, classic style of Chablis that is not expensive at all, and it's wonderful and beautiful, and that's definitely one of my favorites that we had. We also did some wines from Saint Brie for the Chablis section, and one was the Clotilde de Vennes, and they make a Cremant de Bourgogne that's actually from Chablis, and that's also like a standout, and it's probably like less than $20 retail. It's great.
Yes, I love that wine, and you can periodically find that at Amphora. We'll pour that wine by the glass because I agree, it's so delicious.
Yeah.
And speaking of Burgundy, you've done several harvests in Burgundy earlier on in your career. Yeah. Tell us about that. I have never done a harvest in Burgundy.
It was kind of in the beginning, before I even really knew I was going to be involved in wine forever, I think. So I tasted a Burgundy here in New York. I'd never tasted a wine like that before, and then decided I'm going to go to where it's from to learn about it and figure it out.
Get out of here. That's really how that happened?
Yeah, that's really how it happened. Wow. Yeah. I was a waiter at Pastis. Yeah. And they would do these like incredible staff reserve tastings and open up really old, like, Les Wah and like also like Chave and all these crazy wines. I don't know how they used to do it. For the entire staff of Pastis and Balthazar. Oh my God. Yeah, it was insane. Anyway, I jumped in head first, decided I want to go to Burgundy, emailed anyone I'd ever met working with wine or wine relations and got back 1 million no's and one yes. And it was from this producer in Burgundy who's an American guy named Blair Pethel, and he's the owner of Domaine du Blair in Savigny-les-Bains. And he said, yeah, come on down. I need some people to help me out. So I went 2009. I went early and stayed later. So I was there for like 3.5 to 4 months, really, just helping him out, working, doing cellar work after harvest. And as you know, in Burgundy, it's great because it's not just one wine. You know, we made 14 different wines, all like, you know, just a couple barrels each.
Yeah.
So I got to really see the whole of Burgundy while I was there, and it was great.
Right. I'm sure that now, as the wine director of Blue Hill, you know, you email these guys and they're like, yes, what can I do for you? Absolutely. But did you get a feeling as to why the nose came? I know I speak with Italian producers often, and they actually, the government has made it very challenging for them to accept even free labor because of a taxation. One winemaker in Piedmont was telling me that, in fact, during harvest, the government flies helicopters over his vineyards, over all the vineyards, to count the number of vineyard employees to make sure that they are representing accurately how many people are working for them.
I'm pretty sure it has to do with the legal aspect of it. If they do get, you know, some sort of run up from the government and they get caught, people there without papers, I think they can get in some big trouble. I'm really not sure why.
What would you do? Would you recommend someone who's like looking at your story and going to work from server to, you know, wine director of one of the best restaurants in New York, and they say, I would love to do a harvest in Burgundy. What would you recommend to someone who's interested in that?
I think just asking around. I think maybe trying to find something through a university. Like in Burgundy, you can maybe possibly go through like the CFPPA. That's what it's called, the school there. And see if they have some sort of internship / externship program where you don't really have to be a student type of thing. I think there's those type of programs. Other than that, just asking everybody. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will just say, yeah, come help me out for a few days.
Yeah, and there's no harm in that.
Yeah.
So what did you learn during your time in harvest specifically that was maybe more was applicable to you and your job as sommelier? And, you know, you're also at Blue Hill, at Blue Suit and Barbalude, and now as your job at Blue Hill.
Well, I think when you're in Burgundy, you're there, you're in the middle of the landscape, so you see everything kind of comes together. You can read it in books a million times, but until you're there and you see it, you can really understand the geography, the history, why Grand Cru is Grand Cru, you know, why Premier Cru and Village are a little bit, you know, lesser thought of. But also the winemaking. You know, when people talk about pigeage and batonnage and all these things, you're like, okay, you can kind of picture it in your head. But when you see it, when you actually do it and you can see what it does and watch the color get darker when you're doing certain things of certain wines, it just makes so much more sense. It makes it easier to explain it to people, which I think is the best part.
Yeah, and I find for me, it helps me when I'm talking to producers to understand what are some of the things that they have to go through, and then even to ask other questions that I really want to know, but I have more of a context behind it, just having seen it before.
Yeah, totally.
I think that's really helpful. So at Blue Hill, Chef Dan Barber's vision is to have a restaurant that focuses on sustainability. How does that translate into your wine list?
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely sustainability, but it's number one flavor for Dan, and he'll be the first to tell you that. It has to taste really delicious, and I bring that philosophy to the wine list as well. You know, obviously, as a wine bar, you taste a lot of wine all the time, And there's a lot of wines with great stories, and there's nothing better than tasting a wine that's delicious and then has this great story to back it up. But that's usually what I look for first.
Yeah. So my girlfriend Alyssa and I both just finished Dan's new book, The Third Plate.
Mm-hmm.
And through the book, Dan speaks of several important moments in his career. It seems pretty recently where he's had these like really big aha moments and has even with the idea of deliciousness and sustainability has evolved on certain things like flour, for instance, I think was a really big one for him. Have you seen that going on in the restaurant as well? Has there been a change that's distinct, or did that kind of all that stuff happen before the book was complete?
It kind of all happened at the same time. So I've been at Blue Hill now for 2 years, and last April, May, we changed the menu format to either prefix menu or tasting menu only. And what that did was take away that entree that's, you know, one really large piece of meat with a little bit of kind of garnish with it, and turn the idea around into, you know, Dan's idea of the third plate, which is, you know, more vegetable focused. Cuts that are definitely not these prime cuts. You can utilize the whole animal when you buy the whole animal, that kind of thing. So with that, you know, we're doing a lot more wine pairings and things like that. So the entire restaurant changed really last year.
You know, one of the aha moments for me as a reader of the book was when Dan was talking about, and I don't know if you've, I'm sure you've read it.
I read it like five times.
Like five times, yeah. At least, and have bought 20 copies for all your friends and family. Dan was talking about, you know, it kind of doesn't matter if you are working with a local farm who, treats their animals humanely and doesn't use any chemicals. If you're only using part of the farm, if right. you're only using the you know, the lamb chop, you know, or right. the prettiest tomatoes, it's still not as sustainable as you can be. It has to be more of a full entire ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that's translated to the menu.
Yeah, completely. I mean, there's one dish in specific that he has on the menu sometimes, and he calls it the rotation risotto. And it's with this guy, Klaus Martens, who, you know, grows all these different grains, you know, throughout the year, throughout the season, a lot of them not very prized grains like emmer and things like that. And we utilize all of that so we can really support him as a whole, as opposed to just buying like, you know, his farro or something like that. Yeah, which is cool.
That's really cool. That was also written about. I'm a big fan of the book. I really love it. I really want to taste this risotto. It was also recently announced that Blue Hill is going to be reinventing itself from March 13th through the 31st. Tell me if those dates are accurate.
Yep, that's accurate.
As a pop-up called Wasted.
Yeah, next week.
That's next week. Is that March 13th?
Next Friday.
Oh my God, I can't wait for spring. It plays off one of the themes that Dan brings up about utilizing all parts of the animal and the food system. So tell us more about Wasted and what's going on.
So yeah, it's going to be an entirely different restaurant from, I mean, everything, the decor, the staff uniforms, the menu format, the wine list, the beverage list. Everything is going to be completely different. It's going to be it's not Blue Hill. It's Wasted now. It's the name of the restaurant. And it's essentially a restaurant that revolves around things in the food system that are normally wasted, to maybe bring attention to these things that maybe shouldn't normally be wasted. So that's really the whole idea of it. And there's going to be guest chefs every night, lots of big names, which is great. And, you know, we have our Wasted menu that we're going to have, and then each chef comes in and prepares one dish for the day that they're there as like a special for the day.
Wow. And how does this translate into the beverage program?
Well, it was difficult for me at first. I thought, okay, Wasted wine. What do you have? Wasted wine. You have like leftover wine, but leftover wine generally is leftover and then it goes bad right away. Yeah. It's not something that can be saved. So we are going to have some cocktails based off of that. So we've reached out to different people, distributors and things like that, who have these big tastings coming up, who have a ton of leftover wine that just gets tossed. So I'm going to be using some of that to make different cocktails out of it. And then for the wine list, we're just going to do...
So it's going to be wine that's left over from the distributor tasting that happens that day.
Yep.
So like the dregs of the wine will come into... That is so cool.
But it's not even... dregs. Like you've been those tastings, you'll see at the end, like it's nearly full bottles sometimes. True. So yeah, I'm going to go to the end of the tasting, collect it all, bring it back, figure out what I'm going to do with it each day, and then go. And then, we're also going to utilize, you know, champagne that's not quite as bubbly as it should be, that usually gets tossed, or that, you know, I don't know if like you, but Blue Hill, the staff always drinks, and, you know, that kind of thing. And then for wines by the glass, we're just going to do wines from, you know, waste conscious wineries. So wineries that are aware of their impact on putting waste out there. One big one is Shin, who is like extremely waste conscious. Shin in the North Fork of Long Island. You know, they're solar and wind powered, and, you know, all of their like pumice left over from wine goes into compost to be used as fertilizer for the next year. So highlighting stories like that and pouring it all from large format.
Yeah. Shin is also, I think, one of the best places to stay for a trip to the North Fork. They used to run Home Restaurant here in very close by to Blue Hill, actually. And boy, do they put together, it's like a bed and breakfast, but they like will grow the, you know, they'll raise the chickens for the egg and make the jam themselves from their garden. And it's like the most killer breakfast and just a great place to stay out there.
I've never been. I gotta go.
You gotta go.
I know.
And they're the nicest couple, and I'm in love with their dog. The another winery that you might think about is Salchetto Winery in Vino Nobile. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
No, I don't know it.
They produce energy using sustainable methods. I think mostly solar, and they actually produce enough so that they sell it back to the Italian grid. So they're like a carbon negative winery, and the quality I think is quite good there. We actually have to take a very quick break, but we're going to be back with more of Michelle Bichelia from Blue Hill after this. This one's called Write It Down by The Landing. This is In The Drink.
Program was brought to you by VisitNapaValley.com. Welcome to the Napa Valley, North America's legendary wine and food capital, where the art of living well is defined and each season holds a story waiting to be discovered. Life feels slower here, lived at a place where tables are set with care. Fine wine and food are created from the bounty of our own vineyards and gardens, and relationships with friends and family gathered around the table are somehow sweeter. When planning a trip to the Napa Valley, we invite you to visit the destination's official visitor website, visitnapavalley.com, or stop by Napa County's official visitor information center, located in downtown Napa, where our friendly and knowledgeable community ambassadors can assist you in creating your own legendary Napa Valley experiences. The Visitor Information Center is located at 600 Main Street, Napa, and is open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., 7 days a week, 360 days a year. Your invitation to experience the Napa Valley beckons. Take a deep breath, lose yourself in our quiet green and golden hills, renew your body and spirit, taste our legendary wines and cuisine, and experience the people who make this valley like no other in the world. For more information, go to visitnapavalley.com.
All right, and we're back on In the Drink. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, here with Michelle Bichelia from Blue Hill, and we're talking about this very special 2.5 week or so pop-up that Blue Hill, New York City, is doing called Wasted.
Wasted. Wasted. Also, waste ed, as in waste education.
Oh.
Kind of, yeah. Double entendre right there.
I like that. Yeah. So it's happening for pretty much 2.5 weeks from March 13th through the 31st, as we said. How does someone get involved? If I want to, can you buy tickets? Do you make reservations?
You can make reservations. Well, we we are directing everybody to the website. It's wastedny.com, wastedny.com. And we will be taking reservations up until 9 o'clock every night. And then after 9 o'clock, we're going to take walk-ins. So give people a chance to kind of, you know, get in without getting those reservations right off the bat. And I'm sure industry people are going to want to come on the later side. Mm-hmm. So we're really expecting that to happen.
And you said that there's going to be some really exciting chefs. I know from the cocktail standpoint, Dale DeGroff and Jim Meehan are both going to be making drinks for you. Who are some of the chefs that you're really excited about that are going to be participating?
Daniel Hume is coming. Alain Ducasse, Mario Batali, April Bloomfield. It's a great, great lineup of people.
Wow.
Pretty exciting. So I'm probably going to want to work every night just to meet them all. Yeah. Yeah. What an experience. It's awesome.
What have you been doing to prepare to get ready for this?
What haven't we been doing? I mean, if you think about it, we're going to close for a day to transform the entire interior of the restaurant. So you can imagine what that is like.
For a day. That's like some crazy reality show. It says, change your restaurant in 24 hours.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm not doing any of that, you know, that stuff that there's a team doing that. But it definitely impacts us. We have to plan, you know, you have to maybe like slow down your regular wine delivery, that kind of thing. Figure out what you can do to make space for all these new things coming in. You know, make it look nice. There's guest chefs, got to clean it up a little bit. We're doing that for sure. But also, you know, getting the staff ready. It's a different type of service. It's a different menu. You know, everything is different. So it's really getting the staff and the team and the whole restaurant ready to go before it hits next Friday.
Wow. I'm excited. I'm going on the website tonight. I'm going to try to figure out time to get there. Looking over at your wine list, I just huge compliments. I think you have just such an exciting and special wine list.
Thank you.
I've also noticed on your drinks list, you have some pretty cool products that you don't see everywhere, such as Blue Hill Sweet Vermouth and Husk Cherry Limoncello. And those things kind of stuck out to me. Can you tell me about, are you making those in-house and what goes into their preparation?
At the moment, it's more the current service director, Katie Bell, who does that. She has this great sweet vermouth recipe. Actually, don't know where she got it from now that I think about it. And it's awesome. And we make it, you know, maybe once a month or that kind of thing. And it's on the list, but it's also something really fun and special to pour for our friends and for other industry people when they come in as kind of a thank you on their way out. And the same with the Husk Cherry Limoncello. That's a little bit more of a punch to it because it's limoncello. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's we can switch it up and change the fruit that we are putting in there. So Husk Cherry, they're pretty tart.
Yeah.
Sour little things.
Husk Cherry. And yeah, it's such a end of summer. I always call them Cape Gooseberries, but someone told me recently that they can also be called Husk Cherries.
People ask all the time if they are gooseberries at the restaurant. But I don't think they are.
That's such an interesting way to interpret limoncello. I really love it. I also noticed that you have a collaborative beer with one of my favorite brewers, Stillwater, mm-hmm. called Once in a Lifetime Ale.
Yeah, it's
How
cool.
How did this come about? Yeah.
The story's pretty neat. So there's a guy named Glenn Roberts from Anson Mills. Have you ever heard of him before?
Yes, it's the polenta that we use for our polenta alla spianatora right. Lipicio.
Yeah. So Glenn, you know, has lots of different wheats, corns, grains, things like that growing. He has one called Red Fife. And what happened with the Red Fife is that it naturally malted in the field, which is like almost, I don't know, never, never happens. So when that happens, they can't really use it for much on their end. It has to be this perfect combination of temperature, humidity. It has to start malting, and then the sun has to come out and then dry it up. So it's, you know, this like whole malting process that you would normally pay someone to do or do it in your own brewery just happened. So he called Dan and said, "Hey, I have this malted Red Fife. Can you do anything with it?" And Dan said, "Yeah, we'll make a beer called Stillwater. Stillwater, we have this malted Red Fife. Great, let's make a beer." Made a beer, bottled it, called it Once in a Lifetime because it happens once in a lifetime. And it's a Saison-style farmhouse ale, and it's delicious.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's awesome. It's literally like it it can't be repeated next year.
No, it can't. Once it's gone forever, and then that's it.
Oh, my God.
It's almost gone.
I've got to try this.
Yeah.
How is it? What does it taste like?
It's like Saison style. Saison. So light citrusy. Saison. Yeah, a little bit of like that like coriander kind of thing you get, but super clean, really fresh tasting beer. It's good.
Wow. I imagine once it hits 50 degrees in New York, that's going to be like
the pounder.
greatest beer ever.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. We use that for wine pairings and throw it into beverage pairings, I guess, a lot too, because it's so versatile.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Hill at Stone Barns is one of the most unique restaurants in America and probably one of the more memorable experiences I've ever been to. It's a farm that you guys have just about an hour north of the city. Mm-hmm. Is there any collaboration that you have with the restaurant up there, with the wine program up there? How does the relationship between the two restaurants work?
For food, obviously, yes. I mean, everything comes from the same place between Stone Barns and also Blue Hill Farm, which is the Dan and David's Barber's family farm up in Great Barrington. For beverage, we don't do that much collaboration together. We'll do a little bit so that we can, you know, buy like a large quantity of something and then both sell it at the same time. They have this huge, beautiful built-in natural cellar, you know, up there. Have you seen it?
I've seen it. I can imagine. I mean, it made me jealous. I can only imagine what it does.
Yeah, and I have, you know, like a shoe closet essentially as wine storage in the city. And so what's great is, you know, we'll email back and forth about certain wines that we both want to put on the list together, but then I can also utilize that space if I really want something and say, hey, you know, I want this wine stored up there and then bring it down later on the food transfer. So the wine comes down, you know, with the pig, basically, which is awesome. And you know, if there's two guys that work up there and if they need a day off or, you know, they're both MS students. So I go up there and I'll work and fill in, you know, put together mixed cases of wine and just label them and then send them down.
And then just send them down. You're like, yeah. You're like happy to you know, fill in a shift for you. Oh, by the way.
Yeah. No, and they're great. They're really great at letting me do it, and you know, it also helps them move some inventory that maybe's been there for a while. But they have so many, you know, older wines that I don't really have in the city. So I'll have, you know, two bottles of this, two bottles of that, one bottle of this, and then can have it, you know, whether it's on the list or off the list, just to have on hand, which is great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure that right now with Wasted coming up, you're probably holding off on building out the list, but what area of the wine list are you really looking to expand and focus on?
Well, the list of Blue Hill, it's organized differently than any list I've ever worked with. Because it's not organized by region, it's organized by style of wine. So for example, white, you know, there's a crisp and bright page, there's an elegant and round page, and a medium and rich page, and a couple others. So you can kind of play around a lot with that, especially with the reds, because we have a smooth and earthy, ripe and luscious, big and bold. So you can fill in the gaps of these wines. It doesn't have to necessarily be the same wine or even from the same region. So I don't really think about it in a regional sense. I think about it in a stylistic sense as far as buying wine.
Seasonally, so in the winter, you fill out the richer and fuller wines and...
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it happens naturally because that's what people go for automatically. And then now we'll start filling up, you know, the light, fresh whites and build a whole rosé page and that kind of thing.
So I can imagine that last year at this point, when you were filling out the light, fresh whites and the rosés, you probably thought about it maybe a little bit differently than now. What are the wines that you're excited about now to put on those that maybe didn't see the list last year?
I think more wines that kind of fall in that elegant and roundish category, like Chablis, Chenin Blanc, those kind of things that are more food versatile, versus just a light, fresh white wine. Because I think those are wines you can really recommend to guests if they want to drink, you know, one bottle of white wine to go with everything, which happens a lot. That happened a lot that kind of this time last year, people really wanted to make that transition into white wine, but they didn't want to commit to more than a bottle, although they usually do after the fact. But those kinds of things, I think, are what I'll add on.
Yeah. And you're going through, So is it there's a wine pairing option as well?
Mm-hmm.
So people can choose. I mean, what would you recommend to most guests? Do you think that going for a bottle and they could see how the one bottle pairs with various things and really understand the wine through the lens of different foods, or to go through tasting many different things?
I think the pairing, it's fun. It's always something that's not, it's not like we're not using by the glass wines. It's always something different and new. It's not listed because it changes every night. It changes. And sometimes, you know, if there's a certain dish that the chef wants to send out to somebody and they're doing a wine pairing and I don't have something open that goes with it, I'll just open up something and then we'll use that. And we never have to worry about it because we do so many wine pairings that it's really easy to do that. Mm-hmm. But I think the wine pairing is fun because it's, you know, there's stories along with the wines that go with the food, and it's just, it's there to match the food to go with it. So it's great.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exciting being able to taste so many different things and taste all around your list and see what you're excited about. So I think that's, you know, when I come in, that's probably what I'm gonna go for next time.
Yeah, and it's fun because some people are hesitant about doing it because like, oh, it's too much wine. You know, I don't know if I'm gonna drink that much. But we're always open to just work with everybody. You know, if they want to do one taste of white and two reds and play it out like that, like we'll do whatever to make them happy. It's fun in that sense.
Yeah. And then just your thoughts on wine sustainability in general. Is this something that you talk about with your guests? Is this sexy table talk language when getting people excited? Is that part of the story, or is it more about the people that make the wine and the place it comes from?
It's definitely part of the story. The farming practices of the winemakers are definitely something that we like to talk about. People want to hear it, especially at Blue Hill. It's a very specific type of clientele. It's, for me, one of the best clientele I've really had the chance to deal with in New York, because they're educated and they're there for an experience with food and wine together. So they want to hear the stories. They want to hear the background. They want to hear about the farming, the sustainability, if it's organic, if it's biodynamic, you know, whatever they're doing. It's fun. And they want to hear it, and the staff is always happy to talk about it too.
So for the most part, people come in and they know what they're, they know that the food is more sustainable. You don't ever get like, you present someone an organic wine, they're like, oh, is it going to be rotten in some way?
Right.
It doesn't happen.
No, it doesn't happen. It's, people are there who have drank the Dan Barber Kool-Aid one way or another. Yeah.
Well, you can certainly count me and Alyssa and my girlfriend in that. We're huge fans, and it's good to know that that, you know, the wine program there is being shepherded by someone who is such a hospitalitarian, someone who's so nice and so knowledgeable.
Thank you.
And I just love the work you're doing, Michelle.
Thank you so much.
So nice. All right, I can't believe it, but that's been like it felt like that was the quickest show that we've ever done.
It's 30 minutes already.
We'd love to have you back at some point, and cool. we can talk more. But this has been In the Drink today with Michelle Bichelia, and I want to thank our producers Jory Morales and Jack Inslee. Jack's from Heritage Radio Network. And a special thanks to Dan Barber for putting out that great book, The Third Plate. I absolutely love it and recommend it to anyone. Hope that we'll see you next week.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.